if you'd like to develop a team member, now that team member is your audience. So now you have to think about, who is that team member? What language do they speak? What things are they afraid of? What things are going to motivate them? What inspires them? What drives them? Get to know that audience. Value the audience.
Hi there. Welcome to the Business Side of Fitness podcast. This is your host, Vanessa Severiano. Each week on the show, I leverage my 2 decades of experience in the fitness and wellness industry to have meaningful conversations with the movers and shakers behind some of the most well-known and innovative brands in our industry. This show is brought to you by Vanessa Severiano, LLC. To find out more about working with me, click the link in the show notes. And now the time has come to start the show. Everyone's got a story, and it's time to hear from this week's guest. Honestly, it's very hard for me to introduce Roger because first I want to set the stage that we have a lot of history. Roger and Adam Hirsch are the first ones that hired me and gave me the opportunity to enter into the fitness career back in 2001. So I have such high regards for Roger. He was the chief operating officer of Crunch for 13 years. He was the COO of Psych for 5 years. He's been everywhere, but I don't want to do you a disservice by reading some generic intro. I want you to introduce yourself, Roger. So why don't we get things started off with you sharing your background and what led you into the fitness industry and where you are today?
Vanessa, thank you for having me on your show. It's a pleasure to be here. Yeah, and there's a lot that encapsulates the sort of what brought us to this moment right here and now. I started my fitness journey at the University of Michigan as a movement science major. I moved to New York and started in the gym industry. My first job was working at the front desk of Mid-City Gym, a business that's still going. Vince Consalvo was my very first mentor in the fitness industry. And it's been an incredible journey. I was with Crunch, as you said, for 13 years. When I left Crunch, I began to really focus on understanding what had happened at Crunch and how that could be replicated and made better, and how I could become a better version of myself than I had been previously, and really started to look inward more so than I had looked outward before. And doing that in the process of consulting, I started doing some consulting work and ended up owning part of a couple of gyms on Long Island, Big Al's Family Fitness, and helping some other gyms get started. Gotham Gym in New York City is a good example of that. And then had a 2-year sabbatical where I went away and was the primary caregiver for my parents in the final years on earth. And then returned to New York, got into the events business for a bit, helping a friend with his company. I was the chief operating officer for Shecky's Girls Night Out shopping events. And it was a great experience and very relevant to what we do in the fitness industry. And I knew it at the time, but I know more so now how valuable that event experience was and what we're doing every day in fitness. I had joined Psych Fitness, indoor cycling studio chain based here in New York. Worked as the chief operating officer there for 5 years, and then served as the CEO of Switch Playground, hit studio chain based in New York that had a great program. From my experience, the best fitness class I've ever done, still is. But the model was very complex, and it wasn't being managed properly. And we were able to resurrect that business and take it from the verge of bankruptcy to being ready to be cash flow positive until the pandemic in 2020. So I got derailed, but that's part of life. The second law of thermodynamics states that the entropy of the universe increases naturally with time. Entropy is chaos. Science tells us that shit is going to get more chaotic, not less. You know, get used to it because it's not going to change. And So the pandemic happened. I was helping again a number of different people in the industry through consulting, and then found myself being asked to help with a project at New York Sports Clubs, which was my most recent project. I was brought in as the interim CEO for New York Sports Clubs coming out of bankruptcy in December of 2020. We could do a whole podcast episode just talking about that experience. It's one of the legacy brands in the industry. It's been around for 49 years in the New York Sports Clubs. And I'm guessing a lot of your listeners have either worked there or know people who have worked there. It is an icon in the fitness industry, and it had gone through some challenging times. And then the pandemic was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. But went in there, worked with the private bank that had taken over the company, coming in out of bankruptcy, and started as a 30-day project turned into a 14-month project, where we got the ship righted, made enough progress. They were able to find, then patiently go through the process of finding the right long-term CEO fit for their position, and handed off the reins to Bill McMenemy, who's now running New York Sports Clubs and doing a great job of it. And that sort of leads us to where we are now. I served as an advisor to the board at New York Sports Club for the prior 6 months. And now, as I'm moving out of that advisory role, I'm looking for more opportunities to fulfill my purpose, which is to help others. I think that that's kind of a common purpose for people in this fitness industry. We're in this business because we intend to help others. And it's the how and the why and the where and when that we go about doing it that differentiates us, but that's what we're here to do. So that's my story.
Oh my God, that's a high level version of the story. You touched on something earlier that I just want to really dive into, and it was the kind of je ne sais quoi that we had going on at Crunch. I think my career started off at Crunch, and I feel like that was an anomaly. Now, having been, a part of different teams and different businesses, the culture at Crunch was something that I've always been searching to recreate and be a part of again. The culture at, just to put it in context for the listeners, the culture at Crunch was so strong that I still personally keep in touch on a regular, consistent basis with at least 15 to 20 colleagues that we used to work with. And this was over 20 years ago. Like, there was something, there was a glue that put us all together that we all still remain so close through all the twists and turns, different companies, different organizations that we've then moved on to. And I would just, since you were at the helm of Crunch, I would love to hear from your side, what was that special sauce that created that company culture?
I agree that it was that what happened and the experience that we had at Crunch was definitely special and it was unique. And I don't say that to make somebody else think that their experience within their organization that they might have been grown out of was any less special or any less unique. But for our context, it was really something else, to the point that you mentioned how many people you stay in touch with from Crunch. I certainly stay in touch with a lot of people from Crunch. I have the signatures of some of my closest friends that came as a result of my work at Crunch, that were coworkers with me at Crunch, are literally tattooed on my body. So yeah, it's fair to say that the connections that we have from back in that time, they run deep. They deep literally into my skin. It's about family. And it's about an approach that we had and that I believe we still have to the practice of living. And this is really what I've been analyzing since I left Crunch, is I sort of been conducting a long-term case study over the experience that I had gone through at Crunch, because I went into Crunch with certain skill sets. I was trained in movement science from an outstanding institution, the University of Michigan School of Kinesiology. And so I had a great science background. And I had a work ethic that came from being raised in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. My first job, I think I was paid a couple dollars a day to crawl on my hands and knees and pick weeds from a vegetable garden at a farmer up the road. I was about 11 or 12 years old. I literally have like a snippet on my LinkedIn page. Somewhere I've shared it. One of my brothers wrote a little piece about it when he and I were kids about working at West McCondra's farm. So I'm literally not afraid to get my hands dirty and do whatever work needs to be done. So I have this, I guess you would call it maybe that sort of blue collar work ethic where you're not afraid to get into the dirt and do what needs to be done. I have the science background, and at Crunch, I learned on the fly the importance of strategic brand and name development and the customer service business and the hospitality business. And it all stems from the intentions that we have. And the secret sauce isn't really such a secret. And it's so simple. It comes down to just loving the experiences that you have. And the, you know, no matter what is going to happen, you know, just love that experience that you have, learn as much as you can from it, appreciate the value of it, forgive yourself and others, because there's a lot of forgiveness is going to have to play a role in here, because as something grows or mistakes are going to be made because people are human. And then, you know, finding a way to teach others what we've learned and to be there to serve others where, you know, we know we, based on experience and pattern recognition, we have a pretty good idea of what might be coming next, and we're prepared and ready to help people with the challenges that they're going to face, which continue to evolve to this day. So we've seen this fitness industry continue to evolve in a way that I think is really good for the world, great for the world, in fact, and it's been through a difficult time.
Roger, the definition of leadership is really something that's subjective, right? Everybody has a different definition. And for you, what does leadership mean?
What does leadership mean? It's a great question. I mean, I'm not going to answer that question immediately. I think I have to, the way my mind works, which is it's a little different maybe than the way some other minds work. I'm going to come back at that, but let's talk about the concept of being a leader. I don't describe myself as a leader. And in fact, I believe that anybody who describes themselves as a leader doesn't understand what leadership is, because you can choose to do things, but people have to choose to follow you in order to make you a leader. A leader is defined by the choices of others to trust in him or her or they to follow them. So if somebody says, I am a leader, well, you say that, but who's following you? Right? And you, maybe you can pay people to follow you. You can threaten people. You can try to drive people to make them follow you. But can you, I guess leadership is the ability to get people to follow you. Leadership is the ability to get people to follow you without threats, without promises that you're not necessarily sure that you can fulfill, that it's, you know, we're proceeding sort of on blind faith here, but I know where I'm going. I tell people very clearly. I had a conversation with somebody earlier today, first time I met them, and I said early on, I said, so you understand my position in on things, whatever you choose to believe is good for you, good on you. I said, but I want you to, I'd like you to understand me better. And I follow science, but I practice faith, because ultimately we have to do things that are going to involve leaps of faith, where we are doing something and we don't know what the outcome is going to be. It's that step into the darkness. And the secret sauce that we had at Crunch, and that I believe that we still have together, like the connection that you and I have, that the people that you and I know, a lot of people who I hope are listening to this, like it's a family. And it's, you know, that family is going to support you and they're going to lift you. The family will lift you for perspective so that you can recognize progress. They will catch you if you fall, forgiving your failures and healing your wounds, and, you know, so that you can choose to rise again. And it's like, that's really what we had there. We had a team, a family of people at Crunch that were really committed to this mission and purpose and cause, and understood that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts.
You just put that so beautifully that honestly, it makes me emotional, because when I just think about, you know, right now, I think there's people use the word family with business all the time. And in so many cases, it's not sincere. It's not true. That's just a line that they use, like a phrase to try to attract people. But in this case, it really was a family. Like, some of the hardest times and the best times of my life were celebrated with people that I worked with at Crunch, and still to this day. And I've just, it's something that is very hard to put into words for people that weren't there. But I think that it's something that every business could benefit from, is creating that company culture that, you know, when you were talking about a leader, to me, a leader is somebody that's, you know, they're not trying to get people to follow them. They just are. They just have those qualities. It's like a magnet. You're just attracted to them. Right.
But, in my opinion, somebody who would like to be a leader should, rather than focus on practicing being a leader, should practice following, follow something. Like, you like, it's under, like, you have to understand what it is. A real true leader practice. I have, this is, I can go down this leadership rabbit hole, you know, for a long time, but it's leaders practice following. So you recognize and you see what others have done before you, and then you follow, and then you make the decision, do I follow in all those steps, or am I going to veer off, and am I going to do something different and go into the unknown? The, you know, my core fundamentals are built on a few processes that, and again, I was doing all of this while I was at Crunch, but it's really required the past couple of decades to really get an understanding of it. And I've begun to document it into a curriculum of sorts. And it starts with the process of accepting experiences, right? And I foreshadowed this earlier, right? Experiences happen to everybody. And you can apply any emotion that you'd like to whatever experience happens to you. You can anger, hatred, jealousy, excitement, enthusiasm, yada, yada, yada. Go through them all. There's a gamut of them. But I believe that the best investment to make on any experience is to love the experience. Love it regardless. Because the more that you love it, the more that you're going to learn from it. The more that you learn from it, the more you'll appreciate it. The more you appreciate it, the more that you will become forgiving, both of yourself and of those people that you feel may have caused problems along the way. And now you have this understanding and awareness, and that's when you want to teach. And you like to teach, but what was it? I made a misquote there someplace. They said that Buddha, I think, said that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear, right? You can be ready to teach, but you can only teach those that are ready to be taught and are willing to accept being taught. And so that's the process of accepting experiences. That's the fundamental part of, first part of my professional DNA is love, learn, appreciate, forgive, teach, serve. From there, it evolves into the process of understanding expectations. Expectations, we all have them, whether or not we want to admit it, we all have them. And I have them of myself, I have them of you. I have expectations of what's going to happen with this podcast, and so do you. Listeners tuned in, they expect something of this podcast. What do they expect? They expect to receive value out of it. They expect to be entertained. Maybe somebody expects to laugh. Maybe somebody expects it to be really boring so that they can listen to it and go to sleep. And if that's the case, and if you're listening right now, it's okay. You can go to sleep gently. But for everybody else who's not falling asleep and who's listening, we're going to keep going. But expectations are important. So the process of understanding expectations is another cornerstone of the foundation of this awareness training curriculum that I practice every day, which is organize, communicate, educate, evaluate, modify, and repeat. Now, this process runs in a circle, because I've had conversations with some really smart people who say, that sounds good, but you have the order wrong. You should start with teaching. And I'm like, you should start with education. I'm like, okay, so educate, evaluate, modify, organize, communicate, and then repeat. Now re-educate. It doesn't matter where you start. There's probably a diagnosis that somebody can make that it goes to my OCD. I'm drawn to starting with, like, for me, the starting point is organize. I like to organize and then move on to communication. And that's the process of evolution, and it's happening all around us. And what do people expect from the experience? And in fitness, we have to think about that. What does the customer expect when they walked in the door? What does the employee, potential employee, expect when they walk in the door? What are the expectations that they have? And when you're able to exceed people's expectations, when they get more than they expected, that's a win. That's a win, right? When they get more than they expected if they feel better after experiencing our product or our services and our brand, our name, than they did before experiencing it, then they're going to have that positive, they're going to connect, that feeling is going to be connected to that experience and that name. And that's what we consistently do over time. Further beyond that, it goes into the process of telling stories, which is, I think, important. I'll tell you, you've heard me say this many times, life is a game and the best storyteller wins. That simple. If somebody tells me that their sales are slow, then I tell them, well, tell a better story, because people out there have money. Well, there's a pandemic and the economy, there's inflation and there's a recession or there's all these different things. Yeah, but people still have money. There are people driving around. People are spending money on things. They're spending money on things that they feel are the most important. And if they're not giving it to you, then you're not telling your story in a way that makes them believe that what you're offering is important enough to warrant an investment. So get better at it. Look in the mirror and get better.
I mean, I couldn't agree more with storytelling. And we're telling stories to our staff, right? Because we need to get their buy-in to be able to tell the story to clients. We're telling the brand story to clients and employees. We're telling the story to, creating these stories of why people need to get motivated, why they need to purchase our product, why us, why not somebody else, why they need to, why the team needs to dig deeper and go harder. And I think that's one thing that, honestly, I know we keep saying leadership, but I think that's one sign of a great leader is somebody that can really get their team to buy into the greater vision and moving towards the big picture goal. So when you are, you've been at the helm of so many huge organizations with an enormous staff, how do you develop people that are on your teams?
Listen to them. I used to think that I was a great listener. And then I realized that I was arrogant and an idiot, and I wasn't such a great listener after all. And I practice listening. And I practice listening now regularly, and I'm getting better at it. But really, it's just about listening for the key words that people say and that are floating in their language. And you're going to discover when you listen to people carefully what it is that is important to them and what is going to motivate them to change or to get something done. And then after listening, it again comes down to storytelling, right? So phrasing. So there's a process of storytelling as well, right? So we have accepting experiences, understanding expectations, and then telling stories. And the process of telling stories that I've practiced starts with step one, value the audience. Right? If you'd like to develop a team member, now that team member is your audience. So now you have to think about who is that team member? What language do they speak? What things are they afraid of? What things are going to motivate them? What inspires them? What drives them? Get to know that audience and value the audience. Step two is to remember your purpose. Ultimately, what is your purpose? Because if you focus so intently on doing one thing that you lose your footing, and your position and your purpose, well, now you're floundering. It's not going to actually help you whatsoever. You're going to, that'd be like, going into, there's probably a metaphor there that's not coming to mind. But remember your purpose is important. And again, for me personally, it's to help others. So I'm always focused on, am I helping others? How am I going to make this person's day better? Remembering to pause strategically. There can't be too many times. There's never enough times to just enjoy a pause and a breath and collect your thoughts. Let everything slow down. We don't always have to be going full speed all of the time. So pause strategically. Let everybody catch up. Practice often those things that you intend to do. And so if you intend to develop your staff, then you should practice developing your staff. You should have a methodology to developing your staff, and you should have a curriculum that you're developing people with. All of these things come in time. It's important to invest more than just words. So it can be images, it can be videos, it can be changing the tone and the tempo of your voice, and you can sing it, you can speak it, whatever you're doing, but you can invest more than just words, because there's a lot that you can do to embellish there that changes the delivery method of the story. Be ready to evolve and be willing not to. Everybody talks about change. Change is important. It's important to change. Sometimes it's important not to change. Sometimes there are some things that maybe we got it right. And those are the things that we're willing to stand for. And if you're willing to stand for it, that means you're going to stand there and I'm going to stand for it. And that means that I might get run over. If I'm wrong, then I might get run over. It's like being a rock in a stream, right? Like I'm going to stand here. And that, you mentioned, you hear people talking a lot about family. I hear people say a lot about brands. What do they stand for? If they really dig deep enough to understand what it means to stand for something, people who stand for something are willing to sacrifice it all. So it's important to be ready to evolve, but be willing not to know what you stand for. People need to occasionally do the unexpected as a storyteller. This separates us from the machines, right? I'm pretty sure that Skynet is online. I mean, you know, to AI is developing at a rapid rate. You know, there's the way that the world and the universe that we live in works and operates is going to be vastly different in ways that none of us can yet imagine, or well, at least I can't yet imagine. I'm sure there are people out there who are doing exactly that, imagining it and making it happen with technology and development. So that is all happening all the time. But as humans, we have one advantage over a computer. The reason they can never replace us is that we can do the illogical thing. A computer can break, but it can't make an illogical decision. Sometimes doing something that's illogical is the best strategy. So doing the unexpected on occasion is a great storytelling technique. But more importantly than anything else is to live a story that solves problems. So when you, if you're in the fitness and hospitality and service industry, and you meet somebody, whether it's a member that you're meeting and you're working the front desk, if you're a trainer, an instructor, or a manager, doesn't matter who it is. If the person's a customer, a team member, it's what problems are you going to help them solve? Because solving problems is valuable, and solving problems will get you invited back tomorrow. Personally, I'd like to be invited back again to this life, this universe, where this world we live in. I'd like to be invited back tomorrow. You know, so I'm going to do accordingly today. And doing accordingly means that I'm going to do my best to live the story that solves problems.
Great point. I always tell people in a sales and marketing role, like we are just finding out what the person's problem is, and we're connecting their problem with our solution. Those two variables, we're just connecting the dots. We're just drawing a line between them. And when you think about it that way, it seems so much easier, so much less complicated. And sometimes we need to go back to that simplicity. So Roger, one of those things that you're really great at is solving problems for businesses. What are some of the problems that you've solved for some of your consulting clients, and what do you specialize in?
Well, that's a tricky question. I'm not sure what I specialize in. I think maybe others could tell me better than I could tell somebody else, right? I've, in particular, because of my most recent two projects that I've had, both at Switch Playground and New York Sports Clubs, crisis management, where all hope seemed lost, and so I have the ability to, if I believe in something, to get others to believe in it as well. And I don't force them, I don't coerce them, but I demonstrate through my actions, where I do my best to practice the things I say so that, again, I can live the story that solves that problem. So I can tell you that I believe this works, or I can show you that this does work. And part of that comes from being willing to make sacrifice, or be willing to make a sacrifice, which may or may not ever be called in, but being willing to. So, you know, it's important to put the needs of the organization that you have agreed to serve ahead of your own needs. It's important, and it's not easy, because, you know, if you were to dig really deep into our DNA, you go back thousands of years into human evolution, fighting for survival was a necessity at some point, you know, as humans evolved. But evolution changes things, you know, because fighting for survival might have been the key to success at one point in time, it doesn't mean that that's the same thing that we need to do now. Rather than fighting for survival now, we need to work together for survival. And that's kind of the transition maybe that I'm helping people understand, is that there's a different way that we can approach things. Let's talk about it in terms of competition. People will ask me at any project, they'll use, oh, the competitors in the industry. And I don't, when I was at New York sports clubs, I didn't think of any of the other large gyms or small one-off gyms, you know, mom and pop gyms in small markets. I didn't think of them as competition, or the boutique studios as competition, or the online streaming services as competition. I think of them all as family. They're brothers and sisters in the fitness industry. They're family. And so there might be some healthy sibling rivalry where we're attempting to, you know, do better than one or the other, but there are, I think at last count, but something like 8 billion people on planet Earth. There's a lot of them that need the services that we offer, how to live healthier life and how to be able to move better and move more effectively. We have a great product. And so viewing the fitness industry, not from the standpoint of like, who's the competitor? But no, we're all in this together. If for anything, as an industry, we're competing against other industries. We're competing against technology and pharmaceuticals and entertainment. And we're competing against all of them. We're competing against everybody for their time and attention, right? Everybody's in the same game. Everybody has, they're selling something, and it's to get people to feel better. That's the name of the game. You go to a movie, you'd like to feel better when you leave the movie than you did when you entered. You go into a restaurant, you'd like to feel better when you leave the restaurant than you did when you went in. And the gym, it could be a laundromat. If you take some pharmaceutical product, if you go to a sporting event. The name of the game is feel better. Like, who's going to help me feel better? And who's going to be able to have that feeling of better last for a longer period of time? Ideally, an unending period of time, and progressively getting better. That's where I think fitness has an edge. Because for us to help people feel better, all we need people to do is to trust us. Because if we know our business and we know the science behind it, and if the trainer or group fitness instructor knows how to assign somebody a program that will absolutely positively get them the results that they're looking for, if the person believes them and follows them and does it, they're going to get those results. So it's almost as if we're drug dealers, but the drugs that we deal in are hormones that are generated by the body. Serotonin, endorphins, adrenaline, but those are things that we're generating through the process of exercise. It makes you feel better, and there are tangible results that you can see and feel, and it makes a difference, you know. And we have to practice it ourselves, and we do practice it ourselves. And by demonstrating, again, that's living the story that solves problems.
That was put so nicely. I always say that being in a fitness club is like being in a nightclub, but except for the alcohol, but I like your drug dealer analogy. So Roger, speaking of crisis,
if we give people a free sample and then they come back.
So speaking of crisis management, right now we're going through tumultuous times. When are we not going through tumultuous times, right? There's layoffs, there's cutbacks in the industry. What piece of advice would you give to either an employer that has to lay off staff, or somebody, an individual that is separating from a company?
All right. So the process of separation. What advice would I give to that person? I guess it depends on your perspective and what story you choose to believe. Right? If people have seen the movie Life of Pi, they might understand sort of the reference there, right? There's a couple of different paths that it could go. So if I'm in a position as a manager and I have to terminate somebody's employment, then I believe that I'm doing the best thing for the organization and for that person, right? So they're not performing. They're not meeting the expectations of the organization. And if we've done our best to explain them and it just doesn't seem to be the right fit, then keeping them here is actually doing them a disservice. You need to let them go so that they can go someplace else and thrive. If somebody leaves an experience with me and goes someplace else and thrives, that makes me happy. It doesn't make me sad. If I wasn't in a position to be able to, maybe they had all the talent in the world, but if I wasn't in a position or the organization wasn't in a position to maximize the value of it and they needed to find a better fit, then great, they went and found a better fit someplace else. I'm happy for somebody else. So it's celebrating other people's successes. And, it is one of the best ways that I've found to keep your perspective in alignment that, okay, well, this is what needs to be done. So it must be the best thing. And if it's the best thing, then how it's the best thing. And then you can follow a sort of a progressive train of thought that helps you understand the story better, where it makes sense. Like, oh, this was for the best. There's always a silver lining. Finding it is not necessarily easy. That's where storytelling comes in.
It all comes back to storytelling. It really does, though.
The best storyteller wins, Vanessa.
I know it. I need to craft some good stories. Roger, looking back on the last few decades, you've worked with so many amazing individuals and so many great teams. What accomplishments are you most proud of?
That's an excellent question. I am not proud of any of them. All right. So I think I said earlier, right? I follow science and I practice faith. And in one of these books, there's a proverb, 16:18, says that pride goeth before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. So I am very focused on a daily basis of practicing not being proud of what I've created, because from my perspective, there's a higher power that's actually created the things that I'm enjoying being a part of. So I don't take credit for creation, except the joys and beauties and the gifts of life as it comes. Things that make me happy, I think, what way I can answer your question, say the things that make me the happiest are experiences like this, one with you, Vanessa. So when we met in 2001, I think it was your first job out of college. Is that right?
Right. Yep.
Your first job out of college. And so now here we are, we're 21 years later. And I know what you've accomplished over the past 21 years in your professional career. And I sit in awe. I don't think even getting ready for this podcast and this interview, which we've talked about for a while, and I'm so happy that we're doing it. Hopefully we get good reviews and the audience wants me back. We could do a second one. So obviously, yeah, like and request another a second run, because we have some stories. We could have a lot of fun with this. But I was getting reminders telling me exactly, okay, make sure that your room is quiet and that you have a mic set up. And I was thinking to myself, man, she's good at this stuff. Where the hell did she learn how to do all these things? I wish I was that good at this stuff. And to see you doing so well, and I could go on and on with the number of people that we worked with, the business that have started at Crunch. You're Rob Piella and started Gotham Gym. And they've got Dan Lucas and Keith Payne and Jason Polito started Nimble Fitness. And we could go on. Sue Hitzman started the Melt Method. And oh, geez, we could go on and on. All these people that I was lucky, blessed enough to work with that are now such superstars, that makes me happy that I was able to play some small part in your story and other people's stories. And that motivates me to this day, right? Like right where we are now, to do even more of that, where I'm very enthusiastic about everybody. I meet new people that, you know, older or younger, wherever they are in their career path, and think to myself, wow, like I can see who this person's going to be in 20 years and how amazing they're going to be. And I'm going to be able to sit on a couch and I'm going to watch them on TV winning awards or doing whatever, starring in shows or who knows what they're doing. I'm like, yeah, I know that person. Like, yeah, we worked together way back when. And that makes me happy that I was lucky enough to be able to do that. Not proud, but happy.
That just rings like that. That's kind of like reaffirming something that I always believe, which is business. Like, you can have the best color palette, the prettiest logo, the nicest story, but it's really people that make businesses come to life, right? And it's like you were saying earlier, it's the person, it's the instinct that can't be replaced by technology, right? That's the human capacity. And so when you're assembling a team, when you're working on projects, what is it that you look for in people when hiring?
I look for the ability to get back up. And I've heard it said, I think it's, I wasn't able to find who this quote is attributed to, but I think they said that success is the ability to go from one failure to the next with no loss of enthusiasm. And so when I speak to somebody, and if I'm interviewing somebody for a position, I'm interested in getting to know them and finding out, you know, where they failed. Sometimes in the course of an interview, I will strategically maneuver a conversation, so I'll intentionally trip them up somehow in the conversation, in the intention of knocking them down, figuratively speaking, to see how they handle themselves, asking them a question that I know that they don't know the answer to. And do they attempt to manufacture and invent an answer? Or do they look me in the eye and say, I don't know? One of the best interviews, most momentous interviews I've ever had, I'll leave the person unnamed, but came in a situation like that, where I recognized that the person I was interviewing was actually smarter than me. Well, that's not, I'm not setting the bar very high there, but I knew that this person was smarter than me. But it was interviewing for a position that seemed to be almost below what they should be looking for, but I conducted the interview regardless. And at some point in the course of the conversation, I realized that we were discussing something about the business, and I discovered something that they didn't know. I'm like, oh, in my head, I'm like, they don't know the answer to that question. And so I continued the dialogue a bit longer, and then I asked them a question that would expose that vulnerability, where I would expose it. I was going to ask them a question, and I knew before I asked the question that they didn't know how to answer it. Now, I can't tell you what that question was or the exact circumstance was, because it was many years ago and my memory is not that good. But that is the setting. And I looked at this person and I asked them the question, and they stopped and looked at me and said, I don't know. And then the conversation continued. I said, well, would you like me to explain it further? And I could teach you. And then it actually turned into almost like a staff development session with an employee who hadn't even been hired yet for a little bit. And then we went on, and, you know, that person left the interview thinking that it had gone terribly, because they knew that they had been completely caught off guard. They weren't prepared for something. They got asked a question they didn't know. And that was the most impressive interview that I've ever had with somebody, is because when they got caught in a spot where they didn't know the answer to something, they didn't make something up. They just looked at me and they told me the truth. I don't know. And that was awesome. If I could get that, and so I think every interview since then is focused on attempting to recreate that type of situation where I can find somebody, right? Let's see really who they are, because I can promise that everybody in the service and hospitality industry, no matter how many SOPs you have written, and I like to write me a good SOP. I mean, yeah, you give me give me stuff to write down and in order to put it in. Again, I like organize is where I start that understanding and expectations process, because I love it so much. But no matter how many SOPs you have written, something is going to happen during the course of almost every single day that you weren't prepared for. Good Lord knows what it was. I was at the World Trade Center working at a gym in 1993 when it was originally bombed. I was 21 floors directly above the bomb. I finished my lunch in the sub-basement cafeteria about 19 minutes before that bomb went off, right? we had done some emergency action planning and training. We weren't prepared for a bombing. You have to figure it out on the fly when you go. And so that is the one thing that will always happen, is the unexpected is always going to happen or has the potential to happen. And so you need to really understand how people are built to last. And when they are faced with the unexpected, what are they going to do? Are they going to wilt? Are they going to accept responsibility? Are they going to ask for help? And regardless of what those things are, now you better know the person, and then you can work with them and you can maybe help make them aware of those choices. And that's where you get into this sort of what I call my level 4 awareness training program, where we help you learn to go more slowly so that you can recognize the options that you have and that you can choose the way that is best for you. But that's what I look for. I look for that honesty and who a person really is and how they respond to the unexpected situation.
One of the things that story reminds me of is their strength and vulnerability. And that's something that it took me a long time to learn. I used to feel like, oh, if I'm a manager, I have to have all the answers. And now I've learned that if somebody asks me a question and I don't know the answer, I can turn around and say, I'm not sure. What do you think the solution to that problem might be? Let's talk it out, instead of feeling like I have to have all the answers or making something up, being quick to be reactive to come up with an answer that might not necessarily be the right answer. So what's something that you've learned in the course of all these different roles that you've played? Like, what do you know now, looking back on your career, that you didn't know before? Just through all these crisis management, leading teams, managing people, what do you know now?
That it's always going to be okay. That it's always going to be okay. The poet Robert Frost said that I can sum up everything I've learned about life in 3 words. It goes, but it's going to be okay. No matter how bad it might seem to be, if you're in a situation where you have what seems to be an unsolvable problem that you're faced with, well, you're alive. It's far better than the alternative. So things could definitely be worse. So now we've eliminated the worst. And now you're alive. So now you set about solving the problem. And it's, you know, the process of solving problems really starts out with accepting problems, right? And so what do I know now that I didn't know then? I think I have this saved in some place. Bear with me for 1 second. I'm going to look this up in my phone. It's probably a terrible thing to do in an audio format, but I think I wrote this out one time. I did. I said, and appropriately so, I'll send this to you afterwards. It's on an image of the old Crunch at Lafayette Street, where it said, I worked from Crunch from 1993 until 2006. Some other notes on there that I don't need to necessarily share, but I said, message from myself then to myself then from self now. Everything happens for a reason. Don't lose faith just because you don't understand the reason. That's what I've learned. I'll send that to you afterwards. If you'd like, you can share it with others.
Damn, that hits home, Roger. If somebody is listening to this podcast and they want to connect with you, they want to learn more about working with you, how can they do that?
They can. There is a very just simple, very vague inquiry form. You can go to whatisrogerradio.com and submit a form. It's very simple. You can also email me at rogerh@thisislevel5.com.
I'll put it in the show notes. Thank you so much, Roger. I love talking to you.
Same here, Vanessa. Thank you for making time. And thank you for everybody that chose to listen to this.
Hi, everyone. This is your host, Vanessa Severiano. Thanks for tuning into this episode. If it brought you value, please subscribe, review, and share the Business Side of Fitness podcast. If you'd like to learn more about working with me, please click the link in the show notes. Thanks again for listening, and I'll catch you on the next episode.